FBI, and she was through with presidential politics forever. She asked Bernstein to walk back to the office with her to avoid any appearance of furtiveness. While they were waiting to cross the street at 17th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue, Maurice Stans pulled up to 1701 across the avenue in his limousine. "He was an honest man before all this started," she said. "Now he's lying, too." Bernstein studied Stans from across the street as the secretary entered the building. "Okay," she said. "I'll tell you, but it won't do any good. And don't ever call me, or come to see me, or ask any questions about how I know. LaRue, Porter, and Magruder, they all knew about the bugging, or at least lied to the grand jury about what they knew. And Mitchell. But Mitchell is mostly speculation. Take my word on the other three. I know." Frederick LaRue, Herbert L. Porter, and Jeb Stuart Magruder had all left the White House staff to join CRP. About 5 o'clock, the woman telephoned Bernstein. She sounded almost hysterical. "I'm in a phone booth. When I got back from lunch, I got called into somebody's office and confronted with the fact that I had been seen talking to a Post reporter. They wanted to know everything. It was high up, that's all you have to know. I told you they were following me. Please, don't call me again or come to see me." Later that night, Bernstein went to her apartment and knocked on the door. "Go away," she said. And Bernstein and Woodward went off to bang on other doors. About the same time, Clark McGregor called the Post's executive editor, Ben Bradley, to complain about the visits. Bradley didn't tell the reporters about it until months later. But he recalled that McGregor had asked for an appointment with him and Catherine Graham, the publisher of the Post. The appointment was made for the next day, but was canceled by McGregor. "He wanted to talk about your excesses. There were 5 women in CRP," he said, "who had been harassed by you two. And I said, 'That doesn't sound like my boys at all.' And he gave me the names. I said, 'Well, how did they harass them?' And McGregor said, 'They knocked on the doors of their apartments late at night, and they telephoned from the lobby.' And I said, 'That's the nicest thing I've heard about either one of them in years.'" On the evening of September 14th, Bernstein knocked at the front door of a small tract house in the Washington suburbs. Ever since he had lunched with a woman from CRP, he had had a feeling that the owner of this house was the person who had gone back to the prosecutors. He had asked around. "She knows a lot," he was told. The woman worked for Maurice Stans. A woman opened the door and let Bernstein in. "You don't want me, you want my sister," she said. Her sister came into the room. He had expected a woman in her 50s, probably gray. It was his image of a bookkeeper, which is what she was, but she was much younger. "Oh, my God," the bookkeeper said. "You're from the Washington Post. You'll have to go, I'm sorry." Bernstein started figuring ways to hold his ground. The sister was smoking, and he noticed a pack of cigarettes on the dinette table. He asked for one. "I'll get it," he said, as the sister moved to get the pack. "Don't bother." That got him 10 feet into the house. He bluffed, telling the bookkeeper that he understood her being afraid. There were a lot of people like her at the committee who wanted to tell the truth, but some people didn't want to listen. He knew that certain people had gone back to the FBI and the prosecutors to give more information. He hesitated. "Where do you reporters get your information, anyhow?" she asked. "That's what nobody at the committee can figure out." Bernstein asked if he could sit down and finish his cigarette. "Yes, but then you'll have to go. I really have nothing to say." She was drinking coffee, and her sister asked if Bernstein would like some. The bookkeeper winced, but it was too late. Bernstein started sipping, slowly. She was curious. "Somebody is certainly giving you good information if you knew I went back to the prosecutors." Then she rattled off a few names that Bernstein tried to keep in his head. If she was mentioning them as possible sources, they must be people who either had some information or were unhappy with the way things were going down at the committee. He went into a monologue about all the fine people he and Woodward had met who wanted to help but didn't have hard information, only what they had picked up third and fourth hand. "You guys keep digging," she said. "You've really stuck close to home." How did she know? "I ran the totals for the people. I have an adding machine and a deft hand." The way she said it was almost mocking, as if she knew she had been watching Naked City too much. She shook her head and laughed at herself. "Sometimes I don't know whether to laugh or cry. I'm an accountant. I'm apolitical. I didn't do anything wrong, but in some ways something is rotten in Denmark, and I'm part of it." Then she started guessing sources again, and Bernstein tried to keep the name straight in his head. She was glancing at his coffee cup. He tried not to look tense and played with her dog. She seemed to want to talk about what she knew, but to the Washington Post, the enemy? Bernstein had the feeling he was either going out the door any minute or staying till she had told the whole story. "My only loyalties are to Maurice Stans, the president's re-election, and the truth," she said. Bernstein had heard that Stans' wife was sick and in the hospital. He asked how Mrs. Stans was, and then inquired if the secretary was going to end up a fall guy for John Mitchell. "If you could get John Mitchell, it would be beautiful. But I just don't have any real evidence that would stand up in court that he knew. Maybe his guys got carried away, the men close to him." "What guys?" Her hands were shaking. She looked at her sister, who shrugged her shoulders noncommittally. Bernstein thought he had an ally there. The sister got up to get another cup of coffee. He took a gulp and handed his cup to her. She refilled it. Bernstein decided to take a chance. He removed a notebook and pencil from his inner breast pocket. The bookkeeper stared at him. She wasn't going to say anything that they probably didn't know already, Bernstein told her. And absolutely nothing would go into the paper that couldn't be verified elsewhere. "There are a lot of things that are wrong, and a lot of things that are bad at the committee," the bookkeeper said. "I was called by the grand jury very early, but nobody knew what questions to ask. People had already lied to them." "Sally Harmony?" "She and I haven't discussed it, but Sally and others lied." The bookkeeper had worked for Hugh Sloan, and after he quit, she was promoted to work for Stans. There were a few of us they were worried about who got promotions. "Sloan is the sacrificial lamb. His wife was going to leave him if he didn't stand up and do what was right. He left because he saw it and didn't want any part of it. We didn't know before June 17th, but we put two and two together on June 19th and figured it out." She changed the subject. A few days earlier, the Post had reported that there was another participant in the bugging whose identity had not been disclosed, and that he had been granted immunity from prosecution and was talking. The bookkeeper started to speculate out loud. "Baldwin? He wasn't even on the payroll." She tried two other names. Bernstein shook his head. He had no idea who it was. "It has to be one of those three," she said. "I'm pretty sure it's Baldwin." Bernstein asked if she knew who had received transcripts of wiretapped conversations. "I don't know anything about how the operational end of the espionage worked," she said. "I just know who got the money and who approved the allocations. And from what I can see, you've got all the names. Track a little upstairs and out of the finance committee," she advised. "It was the political people. It won't make any difference. You've got to get the law on your side if anything's going to be done. The indictments are going to get the seven, and that's it. The power of the politicians is too strong." "How many people were paid?" 13 or 14 from the fund, but only 6 or 7 are involved. The grand jury didn't even ask if there were any payments that were extra legal." "Did Stans know who received such payments?" "He knew less than I knew. My loyalty is to Hugh and Mr. Stans," she stressed. "For some reason, Mr. Stans feels we have to take the heat for a while." She had talked to Sloan that morning, and he had mentioned a story in the New York Daily News that gave the impression that Sloan knew of the bugging operation. I told him he should sue, but all he said was, "I want out." The grand jury didn't ask him the right questions either, I guess. Who knew all the answers to the right questions? Liddy and Sally Harmony. She has more information than I have, but she has never talked to me about what she knows. I urged her time and time again to do what's right. Sally got promoted, too. She was now working for Robert Odle. Was Odle involved? Certainly not in knowing anything about the bugging. He's a glorified office boy, Magruder's runner. Jeb's definitely involved, of course. It was all done on the political side. That's common knowledge. All the people involved are with the political committee, not finance. But she wouldn't say who beyond Magruder. Magruder was CRP's second in command. Bernstein started guessing, picking names that he remembered from the GAO list. Lang Washburn? He had forgotten that Washburn was in finance, not on the political side. Are you kidding? Lang's so dumb that the Monday after the bugging, he called everybody in finance together to say that we had nothing to do with it. And then he asked Gordon to say a few words to the kids, at which point Gordon Liddy got up and made a speech about how this one bad apple, McCord, shouldn't be allowed to spoil the whole barrel. Bernstein asked the sister for another cup of coffee and tried another name. Never. The White House got him out because he didn't like to do all the crazy things they wanted. Who? Right under Mitchell, the bookkeeper suggested. Bernstein tried LaRue and Porter. She didn't respond. He tried again. Silence. What evidence did she have that Mitchell's assistants were involved? I had the evidence, but all the records were destroyed. I don't know who destroyed them, but I'm sure Gordon did some shredding. Was it hard evidence? It wouldn't positively say they planned the bugging. It wouldn't necessarily implicate them with this, but it would come pretty close. How could she tell it linked them to the bugging? There was a special account before April 7th. Back then, they were just expenditures as far as I was concerned. I didn't have any idea what it was all about. But after June 17th, you didn't have to be any genius to figure it out. I'd seen the figures, and I'd seen all the people, and there were no receipts. Liddy was among those who received the money, she said. Gordon's a case of loyalty to the president. He'll never crack. He'll take the whole rap. The bookkeeper was looking at Bernstein's coffee cup again, having second thoughts. There are too many people watching me, she said. They know I'm privy, and they watch me like a hawk. She was convinced her phones were tapped. How much money was paid out? A lot. More than half a million? You've had it in print. Finally, it clicked. Sometimes he could be incredibly slow, Bernstein thought to himself. It was the slush fund of cash kept in Stans's safe. I never knew it was a security fund, or whatever they called it, she said, until after June 17th. I just thought it was an all-purpose political fund that you didn't talk about, like to take fat cats to dinner, but all strictly legal. $350,000 in dinners? How was it paid out? Not in one chunk. I know what happened to it. I added up the figures. There had been a single sheet of paper on which the account was kept. It had been destroyed, the only record. It was a line sheet with names on about half the sheet, about 15 names with the amount distributed to each person next to the name. I saw it more than once. The amounts kept getting bigger. She had updated the sheet each time a disbursement was made. Sloan knew the whole story, too. He had handed out the money. Bernstein asked about the names again. He was confused because there were about 15 names on the sheet, yet she thought only 6 were involved. Which 6? Go down the GAO report. I think they've all been before the grand jury. They're easy to isolate. A couple have been named in the press, but not necessarily in connection with this. How were the funds allocated? Telephone calls had something to do with how the money was doled out. Only 3 of the 6 had actually received money. The involvement of the others includes answering some telephone calls, she stated. Who were the six? He asked again. Mitchell's principal assistants, the top echelon. Magruder is one. He started throwing out more names. No use. He tried initials. If she told him their initials, she could truthfully say she had never given Bernstein the names, and he would at least be able to narrow down the candidates. Early in the conversation, she had not answered when he had asked if LaRue and Porter were involved. He tried L. L and M and P, and that's all I'm going to give you, the bookkeeper said. Bernstein finished his coffee. He wanted to be able to come back, and he had already pushed too hard. Thanking her at the door, he asked who at the committee might know something and be willing to talk about it. She mentioned the name of the woman who had been followed to lunch with Bernstein. Heading for the Beltway, Bernstein stopped at a phone booth and called Woodward at home. Between the coffee jag, the euphoria of the moment, and the information he was trying to keep straight in his head, Bernstein sounded overexcited. He also didn't want to say too much on the phone. The paranoia was catching. He said he'd be right over. Woodward typed as Bernstein dictated his notes and filled in the gaps. The implication seemed clear. The money in Stanza's safe was related to the bugging operation. Liddy had received some of it, but most important, Mitchell's assistants, including Magruder, had also gotten some of the money and were aware of the espionage operation. Woodward had turned on the stereo full volume and typed at the top of the page, "Interview with X, September 14th. Then he passed Bernstein a slip of paper and asked him who the information was coming from. Bernstein wrote the bookkeeper's name on it. Late the next day, September 15th, the indictments were handed down by the grand jury. As expected, Hunt, Liddy, and the five men arrested on June 17th were indicted. The seven men were charged with as many as 8 separate counts each, all related to conspiracy, burglary, and the federal wiretapping statute prohibiting electronic interception of oral communications. In its story, the Post noted that the indictments did not touch on the central questions about the purpose or sponsorship of the alleged espionage. Attorney General Richard Kleindienst said the indictments represented the culmination of one of the most intensive, objective, and thorough investigations in many years, reaching out to cities all across the United States as well as into foreign countries. At the Post, Bernstein, Woodward, and the editors had become increasingly skeptical of the federal investigation. Why weren't the $89,000 in Mexican checks, the $25,000 Dahlberg check, and the Stans slush fund mentioned in the indictment? How could the indictment be so limited if the government had the same information as the Post? Bernstein telephoned a Justice Department official who had been helpful occasionally and asked how the indictment squared with the bookkeeper's testimony. Hadn't everything she said been confirmed by Sloan? Certainly the government had established through at least those two that the fund in Stanza's safe was tied to the bugging and that the money had been controlled by John Mitchell's assistants. The source was uncomfortable and evasive at first. Then, defensively, he confirmed that the information was there, including the assertions of Sloan and the bookkeeper. Bernstein asked indignantly why the Post shouldn't run a story charging the government with ignoring evidence. There was proof that the fund in Stanza's safe was tied to the bugging, and there were witnesses who knew which higher-ups at the committee were involved. "You're making some bad assumptions. I'll believe you if you put your name on a story that says someone can testify to a fund going for the Watergate." Bernstein recalled that the bookkeeper had said her evidence did not prove conclusively that the money went to the Watergate operation. He rephrased, "Wasn't there a considerable body of evidence indicating that others had knowledge of the bugging operation, and that the fund was central to the involvement of others?" The source hesitated. "If what you say is true, it's going to come out in the wash. The only new things will come out in the trial." What about the people who had come back to offer new information to the FBI and the prosecutors? "It happens in every investigation," the official said, and added, There is nothing you know that we don't know. We've got all the facts. You're not telling me anything. Then this would be the end of it? It can safely be said that the investigation for the present is at rest, in a state of repose. It seems highly unlikely that it will be reopened. Bernstein overstepped good judgment. Maybe the Fed should bring Dick Gerstein and his crackerjack investigator Martin Dardis up to Washington to help out, he suggested. It pisses me off that Gerstein is a member of the bar, said the official. We know the facts. Not Gerstein, not you. Chapter 4 Woodward had a source in the executive branch who had access to information at CRP as well as at the White House. His identity was unknown to anyone else. He could be contacted only on very important occasions. Woodward had promised he would never identify him or his position to anyone. Further, he had agreed never to quote the man, even as an anonymous source. Their discussions would be only to confirm information that had been obtained elsewhere and to add some perspective. In newspaper terminology, this meant the discussions were on deep background. Woodward explained the arrangement to managing editor Howard Simons one day. He had taken to calling the source my friend, but Simons dubbed him Deep Throat, the title of a celebrated pornographic movie. The name stuck. At first, Woodward and Deep Throat had talked by telephone. But as the tensions of Watergate increased, Deep Throat's nervousness grew. He didn't want to talk on the telephone, but had said they could meet somewhere on occasion. Deep Throat didn't want to use the phone even to set up the meetings. He suggested that Woodward open the drapes in his apartment as a signal. Deep Throat could check each day. If the drapes were open, the two would meet that night. But Woodward liked to let the sun in at times, and suggested another signal. Several years earlier, Woodward had found a red cloth flag lying in the street. Barely 1 foot square, it was attached to a stick, the type of warning device used on the back of a truck carrying a projecting load. Woodward had taken the flag back to his apartment, and one of his friends had stuck it into an old flower pot on the balcony. It had stayed there. When Woodward had an urgent inquiry to make, he would move the flower pot with the red flag to the rear of the balcony. During the day, Deep Throat would check to see if the pot had been moved. If it had, he and Woodward would meet at about 2 a.m. in a pre-designated underground parking garage. Woodward would leave his sixth-floor apartment and walk down the back stairs into an alley. Walking and taking two or more taxis to the garage, he could be reasonably sure that no one had followed him. In the garage, the two could talk for an hour or more without being seen. If taxis were hard to find, as they often were late at night, it might take Woodward almost 2 hours to get there on foot. On two occasions, a meeting had been set, and the man had not shown up. A depressing and frightening experience, as Woodward had waited for more than an hour, alone, in an underground garage in the middle of the night. Once he had thought he was being followed. Two well-dressed men had stayed behind him for 5 or 6 blocks, but he had ducked into an alley and had not seen them again. If Deep Throat wanted a meeting, which was rare, there was a different procedure. Each morning, Woodward would check page 20 of his New York Times, delivered to his apartment house before 7 a.m. If a meeting was requested, the page number would be circled and the hands of a clock indicating the time of the rendezvous would appear in a lower corner of the page. Woodward didn't know how Deep Throat got to his paper. The man's position in the executive branch was extremely sensitive. He had never told Woodward anything that was incorrect. It was he who had advised Woodward on June 19th that Howard Hunt was definitely involved in Watergate. During the summer, he had told Woodward that the FBI badly wanted to know where the Post was getting its information. He thought Bernstein and Woodward might be followed, and cautioned them to take care when using their telephones. The White House, he had said at the last meeting, regarded the stakes in Watergate as much higher than anyone outside perceived. Even the FBI didn't understand what was happening. The source had been deliberately vague about this, however, making veiled references to the CIA and national security, which Woodward did not understand. The day after the indictments were handed down, Woodward broke the rule about telephone contact. Deep Throat sounded nervous, but listened as the draft of a story was read to him. It said that federal investigators had received information from Nixon campaign workers that high officials of the Committee for the Re-Election of the President had been involved in the funding of the Watergate operation. "Too soft," Deep Throat said. "You can go much stronger." The bookkeeper had been right about the money in Stans's safe. It had financed the Watergate bugging and other intelligence-gathering activities, he said. John Mitchell's top assistants were only among those who had controlled the fund. He would not say if the former attorney general had had prior knowledge of the bugging attempt. The wiretap logs had reached some of the same Mitchell aides who had disbursed the spying funds, he said. Following the conversation, Woodward read his scrawled notes to Bernstein, who typed a new lead. Funds for the Watergate espionage operation were controlled by several principal assistants of John N. Mitchell, the former manager of President Nixon's campaign, and were kept in a special account at the Committee for the Re-Election of the President, the Washington Post has learned. The story also reported the fund contained more than $300,000 earmarked for sensitive political projects. Gordon Liddy was among those who received money from the fund. Records relating to the account had been destroyed. Hugh Sloan's resignation had been the result of his suspicions about Watergate. Perhaps more important than the specific details of the story was its larger meaning. The Watergate indictments had not broken the conspiracy. And some of CRP's campaign workers had the answers to many of the remaining questions. As the 6:30 deadline for the Sunday paper approached, Woodward called Van Shumway for CRP's response. Half an hour later, Shumway called back with a statement. "There have been and are cash funds in this committee used for various legitimate purposes, such as reimbursement of expenditures for advances on travel. However, no one employed by this committee at this time has used any funds for purposes that were illegal or improper." The statement, taken literally, did not flatly deny what had been reported. That afternoon, George McGovern held a press conference and called the Watergate investigation a whitewash. "What is involved here is not only the political life of this nation, but the very morality of our leaders at a time when the United States desperately needs to revitalize its moral standards," he said. "And that is why I shall pursue this case the length and breadth of this land." The next day, September 17th, both the reporters went to the bookkeeper's house. It was a Sunday afternoon, and she was not inclined to talk to reporters, especially when a page one story in the Post contained facts that only she and a few others at the Nixon committee knew. But she would rather have the reporters out of view than on the doorstep, where they were imploring her to listen to some information they had. She let them inside. They wanted her to tell them exactly who L and M and P were. Liddy or LaRue? McCord, Mitchell, Magruder, Porter? How much money was paid out? What about the others on the list? The bookkeeper was scared and was having second thoughts, but she was calling Bernstein by his first name. Woodward was silent at first. Bernstein was throwing out figures. He stopped at 700,000. "At least that. $350,000 is what's left in the fund." The ice seemed broken. Had she meant Liddy for the L, or had LaRue or someone else with that initial also gotten cash? She wouldn't say. They said they knew Liddy was the only L to be paid from the fund. She confirmed it. An unstated agreement was in the making. She seemed willing to confirm or deny statements if the reporters remained casual and gave the impression that they simply needed confirmation, not primary information. If people were to be convinced that Sloan and Stans were innocent, they told her, it was critical that the Post's reporting be precise. That was where she could help. Morale is terrible in finance, she said. Those of us who know are tired of being suspected. There are little jokes all the time, like, what did you do with the 25 grand, lady? Was that how much Liddy got? She shook her head no. More than 50,000? Woodward asked. She nodded. Magruder got at least that, too, didn't he? Again she nodded. Magruder was the only M to get money, right? Another nod. But, she indicated, there was more to know about Magruder. Let's just say I don't trust him at all, especially where his own skin is concerned, she said. He'll stop at nothing. The last 3 weeks he's turned on the charm to me, something fierce. And LaRue? The reporter said they knew he was involved, too, even though he had received no money. He's very elusive. He covers his tracks, she said. He and Mitchell are like this. She intertwined her fingers. But she would not say what LaRue knew. P.E. was Bart Porter. They were sure of that, they said. He got a lot of money. It was in $100 bills. Everybody got $100 bills. Bernstein reminded her of a joke she had made. We're Republicans, you know. We deal in big figures. Porter, too, had gotten more than $50,000, she said. The bookkeeper was disturbed by the narrowness of the indictments. I went down in good faith to the grand jury and testified, and obviously the results are not there. My feeling is that the FBI turns the information in and it goes upstairs. I just want out, now. Hugh Sloan made the wisest decision of all. He quit. Mr. Stan said I begged him to stay, but he wouldn't. She said that people had evaded the grand jury's questions. Rob Odell said to me after he'd come back from the grand jury, don't you feel like you've been through the ringer? And I said, no, and you wouldn't feel so bad if you tell them the whole truth. She wouldn't go into what Odell might have concealed. The propaganda since the break-in has been, we have nothing to do with this and hold your head up high, she told the reporters as they left. Back at the office, Woodward went to the rear of the newsroom to call Deep Throat. Bernstein wished he had a source like that. The only source he knew who had such comprehensive knowledge in any field was Mike Schwering, who owned the Georgetown Cycle Sport Shop. There was nothing about bikes, and more important, about bike thieves that Schwering didn't know. Bernstein knew something about bike thieves. The night of the Watergate indictments, somebody had stolen his 10-speed Raleigh from a parking garage. That was the difference between him and Woodward. Woodward went into a garage to find a source who can tell him what Nixon's men were up to. Bernstein walked in to find an 8-pound chain cut neatly in two and his bike gone. The tone of the conversation that Sunday afternoon was ominous. When Deep Throat heard Woodward's voice, there was a long pause. This would have to be their last telephone conversation, he said flatly. Both the FBI and the White House were determined to learn how the Post was getting its information and to put a stop to it. The situation was far more dangerous than Woodward realized. The story about Mitchell's aides had infuriated the White House. The call clearly was a mistake. His friend was displeased, even angry at him. But what struck Woodward even more was how frightened Deep Throat seemed. The fear had been building, but Woodward hadn't recognized it until now. Only a part of it was personal. It had more to do with the situation, the facts, the implications of what he knew about. Woodward had never known him to be so guarded, so serious. At their last meeting, he had seemed weighed down. If Woodward was reading his friend right, something was horribly amiss. Woodward told him what he and Bernstein had heard from the bookkeeper about Magruder and Porter. They're both deeply involved in Watergate, Deep Throat responded. He sounded resigned, dejected. Woodward asked him to be more exact. Watergate, he repeated. Then he paused and added, the whole thing. He confirmed that Magruder and Porter had received at least $50,000 from Stanza's safe, and Woodward could be damn sure that the money had not been used for legitimate purposes. That was fact, not allegation. That was all he would say. From there, Woodward and Bernstein would be on their own for a while. A touch of his old good humor returned. "Let's just say I'll be willing to put the blossoming situation in perspective for you when the time comes." But there was disgust in the way he said it. Bernstein was already sparring with the typewriter. Woodward glanced at the lead. Two of President Nixon's top campaign officials each withdrew more than $50,000 from a secret fund that financed the bugging of Democratic headquarters, according to sources close to the Watergate investigation. Woodward reached Powell Moore, the deputy press director of CRP, and told him in general terms what the Post intended to report in Monday's paper. Moore was a jocular 34-year-old Georgian who had worked in the White House communications office before the campaign. "Thanks a lot," Moore said. "That's just what I need on a Sunday." And he was sure the story was untrue. The reporters were getting bad information somewhere. He didn't know where, but he wished they would come off this crusade and check out these things better before putting them in the paper. Woodward saw a lever. The reporters were sure of their facts, he told Moore. They had verified the information with sources in enough different places. But there was always the possibility of some explanation that they might be unaware of. If Moore would get Magruder to call him and discuss the allegations substantively, Woodward would agree to hold the story until after Magruder had his say. And if Magruder could convince the reporters that the story was in any way wrong, or based on some misunderstanding, they would continue to hold it until everything was checked out. Moore agreed. It was a breakthrough, the reporters felt, an opportunity to penetrate the committee's haze of anonymous and ambiguous statements. Magruder called about half an hour later and said it was absolutely untrue that he received any money from any secret fund. "I only received my salary and expense account," he told Woodward. Then how did he account for the fact that the federal investigation had determined he had received at least $50,000 from the fund in Stanza's safe? "I was questioned about it, but it was discarded, and it was agreed by all parties that it is incorrect." The FBI had questioned him extensively. "That's on background," he added as an afterthought. Woodward told him he should know better than to try to put something on background after saying it. Magruder had served as the number two man in the White House communications office before becoming deputy campaign manager. "But you've got to help me," Magruder pleaded. "I'll get in trouble if I'm quoted." Woodward told him he might put that statement in the paper, too. Then, at Magruder's request, they went on background. Woodward told him the Post intended to go ahead with the story unless Magruder could come up with a convincing reason to hold it. Magruder didn't argue. But he asked Woodward to write that government investigators, rather than the FBI, had informed Magruder of allegations against him. "You've got to help me on some of this." It was a small point. Magruder obviously thought that an allegation attributed to the FBI sounded more serious than government investigators. The request didn't seem unreasonable. Woodward agreed. Magruder's tone had made more of an impression on Woodward than his words. He was second in command at CRP. His job at the White House had been to deal with the press, but his voice had been shaking as he talked to Woodward. A section of the story was about Hugh Sloan. Deep Throat had said that Sloan had had no prior knowledge of the bugging, or of how the money was to be spent. He had quit as treasurer of CRP shortly after the bugging because he wanted no part of what he then knew was going on. The story quoted the bookkeeper anonymously. He didn't want anything to do with it. His wife was going to leave him if he didn't stand up and do what was right. There was one problem in writing the story. Deep Throat had been explicit in saying the withdrawals financed the Watergate bugging. But the bookkeeper, who suspected as much, couldn't confirm it. The reporters conferred with Sussman and Rosenfeld, who decided to fall on the cautious side and say the money was used to finance widespread intelligence-gathering activities against the Democrats. Gradually, an unwritten rule was evolving. Unless two sources confirmed a charge involving activity likely to be considered criminal, the specific allegation was not used in the paper. The next morning, the New York Times didn't mention the secret fund stories. At the White House, Ron Ziegler wasn't asked about them. The networks carried neither of the stories, and most papers didn't either. On Capitol Hill, the Republican leader of the Senate, Hugh Scott of Pennsylvania, told an informal morning press conference that the Watergate case was not of concern to the average voter, but of interest to just Senator McGovern and the media. "Nobody is paying any attention to what you're writing," he said. In the newsroom, Bernstein and Woodward waited for the first edition of the afternoon Washington Star News to arrive. The only Watergate story was about a George Washington University law professor who had filed a motion in federal court seeking the appointment of a special prosecutor on the case. Late that afternoon, Bernstein signed out a company car and drove to McLean in the Virginia suburbs to visit Hugh Sloan, the former treasurer of CRP. The trip, ordinarily half an hour's drive, took more than an hour and a quarter in the rain. Sloan lived in a new development, and Bernstein had trouble finding it. The development consisted of imitation Tudor houses clustered along little concrete and grass pedestrian lanes. The place was doubtless designed for families with young children. Traffic and parking areas were safely isolated, and almost every house seemed to have a tricycle or some form of hobby horse overturned on the lawn. Bernstein got soaked as he searched on foot for Sloan's house. Mrs. Sloan answered the door. She was very pretty and very pregnant. Bernstein introduced himself and asked for Sloan. He was downtown and wouldn't be home until 7:30 or so. She was friendly and asked where Bernstein could be reached. Bernstein was looking for a way to talk to her, at least for a while. She had worked at the White House as a social secretary, he knew, and she had been an important influence in her husband's decision to quit the Nixon campaign. He guessed she was about 30. There was a softness about her good looks that seemed to suit the idea of becoming a mother. She had big brown eyes. Bernstein thought these must be awful days for the Sloans. A former assistant on the president's staff, out of work and under a cloud of suspicion, and his wife expecting their first child. At this time when they should be happiest, his name was showing up in the papers every day in a way usually associated with mobsters. She spent her time waiting for him to come back from the grand jury. FBI agents were talking to their friends and neighbors. Reporters were knocking on their door at all hours. Bernstein shared these thoughts with her, trying to disassociate himself from the hordes. She sensed his discomfort. She understood he was only trying to do his job, she said. Like her husband. This is an honest house. It was a declaration. Proud. Firm. Had she read the Post story? Mrs. Sloan nodded. She had been pleased. It had been a relief finally to see what she knew in print. Bernstein told her the Post staff had no preconceived notions. And there were some people who were not concerned about the truth, he added, much less about what happened to her husband. I know, she replied. It was spoken sadly. Her husband had been let down by people he believed in, people whose principles and values they had both thought were the same as their own. But the values of many of the others had been hollow. There was a flash of anger as she spoke, but mostly sorrow. Bernstein wanted to move the conversation away from generalities. They had established a common ground philosophically and seemed to like each other. He certainly liked her. What had her husband's reaction been when he realized what he was being asked to hand out money for? Bernstein was trying to cross the line slowly, but she recognized it immediately. That was something he would have to talk to her husband about. It wouldn't be appropriate for her to say. She asked for his phone number again, and Bernstein wrote it on a page from his notebook. He had another appointment in McLean that evening, he lied. If it ended early enough, would it be all right to come back and talk to her husband? Bernstein was welcome to come back, but she didn't know if her husband would talk to him. Maybe she could convince him. Bernstein smiled, trying to suggest a good-natured conspiracy. She laughed. We'll see, she said. There was a pretty fair bike shop in McLean, and Bernstein drove there to kill a couple of hours and look half-heartedly for a replacement for his beloved Raleigh. But his mind was on Jeb Magruder. He had picked up a profoundly disturbing piece of information that day. Magruder was a bike freak. Bernstein had trouble swallowing the information that a bicycle nut could be a Watergate bugger. And Magruder really was a card-carrying bicycle freak who had even ridden his 10-speed to the White House every day. Nobody would ever steal Jeb Magruder's bike, at least not there. Bernstein knew that because he had ridden his bike to the White House on July 14th. Not the Raleigh, but a Holdsworth that he had had built in London. And as he went through the gate, he knew no one would get near it. So Bernstein had rested his bike against the wall of the little guardhouse at the entrance and not bothered to lock it. He was there to hear Vice President Agnew talk about cutting red tape to help get victims of the great flood caused by Hurricane Agnes. And he had run into Ken Clausen in the hallway. "You guys back at the post are going to bark up the wrong tree one too many times on Watergate," Clausen had said. A few hours later, Hugh Sloan answered the door, looking as if he had just stepped out of the pages of Management Intern News. 30-ish, slim, hair nicely trimmed, just long enough, blue blazer, muted shirt, rep tie, quite handsome, maybe too thin. "My wife told me to probably expect you," he said, and let Bernstein step out of the rain and into the hallway. He left the door open. "As you know, I haven't talked to the press." It was stated apologetically. That was a good sign. One eye on the open door, Bernstein decided to shoot for the moon. The morning story had changed the situation, he argued. People now knew that Sloan wasn't guilty in Watergate. But Sloan knew who was, or at least he knew things that could lead to the guilty. Now that part of the story had come out, Sloan should put the rest on record, clear his own name, and let people know the truth. Maybe there was a legitimate explanation for the cash handed over to Liddy and John Mitchell's aides. If there was, and that was the whole story, so be it. Maybe things were a lot worse even than that day's story had suggested. If they were worse, they're worse, Sloan interrupted. "That's why I left, because I suspected the worst." Suddenly he looked wounded. There seemed to be no vengeance, only hurt. He was shaking his head. "Then why not tell what he knew? Now, publicly. To keep others from getting hurt. In the long run, it would help Nixon," Bernstein argued, "because the president was going to be hurt badly if the cover-up lasted much longer." Sloan nodded. "He would like to," he said. "He really would. But his lawyers had advised against it. Whatever he said publicly might be used against him in any civil suit arising from his role as treasurer of the Nixon campaign." Bernstein resisted the temptation to advise Sloan to get a new lawyer. That's what he would do if he were innocent and in Sloan's place. Get a new lawyer and sue CRP. Sloan had also pledged to the prosecutors that he would not make any public statement before the Watergate trial. "So he was twice bound to remain silent," he said. How sure was Sloan that the prosecutors were on his side? He thought they were, he said, but he didn't have much faith in anybody anymore. Because only 7 people had been indicted? Because of the whole situation. Bernstein remembered that the bookkeeper had said that the lawyers for the committee had been present during all FBI interviews with CRP employees. "That was true," said Sloan. Had the lawyers told Sloan what to say, or to stay away from certain areas? "We were never told in so many words, 'don't talk,'" said Sloan. "But the message was clear. It was always, 'hold ranks,' or 'keep the ship together.'" Did that mean lie? Bernstein could draw his own conclusions, Sloan said, but it was not an unreasonable assumption. Who had conveyed the message? The lawyers? Mardian? LaRue? Well, Mardian and LaRue had been chosen by John Mitchell to develop the committee's response to the Watergate bugging, so they would certainly know about it, Sloan said. They had engineered the response. Was that another way of saying covering up? It definitely didn't mean devising a plan for coming forward and telling the truth, Sloane said. Did Mitchell know of the bugging before it took place? Did LaRue? Mardian? Mitchell knew of the bugging and a lot of other things before they took place, Sloane said. But he had no absolute proof of this beyond the money. Second-hand information and his knowledge of the personalities involved and how the committee worked. Mitchell had to know of the funds. You just don't give out that kind of money without the head of the campaign knowing what it's going for, especially when his people are getting the cash. LaRue was Mitchell's aide-de-camp, Sloane explained. He was probably involved in everything, too. He was less certain about Mardian, who had come to the committee from the Justice Department on May 1st, after the money had been passed around. After June 17th, however, there was no question that Mardian, who had been political coordinator at CRP, had learned all there was to know. Then he and LaRue had started running the show in consultation with Mitchell. Including the destruction of records? That was part of it. The bookkeeper had seemed to imply that the records of the secret account in Stanza's safe had been destroyed immediately after the new campaign law took effect on April 7th. But Sloane said they had been destroyed right after the arrests in the Watergate, along with a lot of other financial records. These included 6 or 7 ledger books, each about 1/2 inch thick, that listed all campaign contributions received before the new disclosure law took effect. There had been a house cleaning after the bugging. They were still standing in the hallway. Sloane kept glancing at the open door, and Bernstein kept trying not to notice. Sloane was uncomfortable. He kept repeating that he was going further with Bernstein than he wanted to go, without having some time to think about it. Bernstein was impressed by Sloane's thoughtfulness. Sloane seemed convinced that the president, whom he very much wanted to see reelected, had known nothing of what happened before June 17th. But he was as sure that Nixon had been ill-served by his surrogates before the bugging and had been put in increasing jeopardy by them ever since. Sloane believed that the prosecutors were honest men, determined to learn the truth, but there were obstacles they had been unable to overcome. He couldn't tell whether the FBI had been merely sloppy or under pressure to follow procedures that would impede an effective investigation. He believed the press was doing its job, but in the absence of candor from the committee, it had reached unfair conclusions about some people. Sloane himself was a prime example. He wasn't bitter, just disillusioned. All he wanted now was to clean up his legal obligations, testimony in the trial and in the civil suit, and leave Washington forever. He was looking for a job in industry, a management position, but it was difficult. His name had been in the papers often. He would not work for the White House again, even if asked to come back. He wished he were in Bernstein's place, wished he could write. Maybe then he could express what had been going through his mind. Not the cold, hard facts of Watergate, necessarily. That wasn't really what was important. But what it was like for young men and women to come to Washington because they believed in something, and then to be inside and see how things worked, and watch their own ideals disintegrate. He and his wife believed in the same things they had before they came to Washington. Many of their friends at the White House did, too, but those people had made a decision that you could still believe in the same things and yet adapt yourself. After all, the goals were unchanged. You were still working for what you believed in, right? People in the White House believed they were entitled to do things differently, to suspend the rules, because they were fulfilling a mission. That was the only important thing, the mission. It was easy to lose perspective, Sloane said. He had seen it happen. He and his wife wanted to get out of Washington before they lost theirs. Bernstein didn't think Sloane would be saying these things unless he was convinced the White House was involved in the bugging and the cover-up of the true story. "I don't know anything hard about what went on across the street," meaning the White House, Sloane said. "But judging from who's involved in the committee, it wouldn't surprise me." In any case, Sloane said, the question was largely semantic. Since the bugging, the White House and the president himself had talked as if CRP were a private company, set up by supporters of Richard Nixon who were intent on drafting him for re-election and contracting his campaign to a consulting firm. But the Committee for the Re-election of the President was the White House, wholly its creation, staffed by the White House, reporting only to the White House. Bernstein asked if the names of any persons still working for the White House had been on that single sheet of paper used to account for withdrawals from the fund in Stanza's safe. Sloan wouldn't say. But Liddy and Porter were a logical grouping, and there had been no withdrawals of amounts comparable to theirs. Bernstein thought, from what the bookkeeper had indicated, that Liddy and Porter had received considerably more than $50,000 apiece. $50,000 was merely where she had cut off the guessing game. Sloan confirmed his suspicions. The total was closer to $300,000. The fund had been in existence for more than 18 months, and it represented cash contributions to the Nixon campaign. Whatever cash had come into committee headquarters was simply shoveled into Stanza's safe. At any given moment, there would probably have been about $700,000 in the safe. Before June 17th, Sloan added, nobody had told him of any specific purpose for the funds. What about convention security, or the term security fund? Sloan had heard of neither until after the Watergate break-in. Then the story began making the rounds at CRP that the money withdrawn by Liddy, Porter, and Magruder had been for convention security, and that Liddy had misappropriated his share, using it to pay for the bugging. But it didn't make sense to Sloan. Legitimate security expenditures were all carefully budgeted, he said, paid for by check and accounted for in reports filed with the GAO. If that had been the purpose of the expenditures, Sloan would have been told when they were made. He was the treasurer, after all. Bernstein asked the obvious question, but Sloan would not say who had ordered him to make the secret payments. He wanted more time to think about Bernstein's suggestion that he go on record. Bernstein said the Post would let him establish the ground rules. How about a taped interview? If Sloan wanted his lawyer present, that was fine. And Sloan could review the transcript and delete anything his lawyer said might give him legal problems, as long as his omissions did not distort the facts. Bernstein wanted to come back with Woodward. If they could get Sloan to relax and to trust them, there was a good chance he might talk unguardedly. Much of what Sloan had said was ambiguous and unclear, but it suggested a broader conspiracy than he was willing to talk about at this point. Sloan asked Bernstein to call him the next day, and he would give him an answer about the interview. And if that were not possible, maybe the three of them could get together on some other basis. They chatted easily for a few more minutes about the baby, any day now, Sloan said, the campaign, the newspaper business. Sloan wondered if newspapers weren't a little hypocritical, demanding one standard for others and another for themselves. He doubted that reporters had any idea of the anguish they could inflict with only one sentence. He wasn't thinking of himself so much, he said, but his wife, his parents. It had been very rough on them. Driving back to the office, Bernstein kept thinking about what Sloan had said in those last minutes. Sloan was never identified as a source in the Post stories. He had been guaranteed anonymity. For this book, he agreed to allow use of his name for the first time. Woodward and he had talked about the problem. Suppose that Magruder and Porter were only fall guys, that someone at the committee or the White House had wanted that day's story so they could pounce on the Post. Or suppose that Magruder and Porter were being fingered to protect somebody else. Bernstein telephoned an FBI agent who was assigned to the Watergate case. He knew the man only slightly, and the agent wasn't happy to hear from him. The weekend stories on the secret fund and on Bart Porter and Jeb Magruder had caused trouble in the bureau, he said. L. Patrick Gray, the third, acting director of the FBI, had personally called the head of the Washington field office and ordered him to make sure the Post was not getting its information from agents there. I don't know how you guys are doing it, but you got access to the 302s, the agent said. And some people think you're getting them from us. FBI Forms 302 were the interview reports filed by agents immediately after talking to witnesses. "Now you come in through the switchboard, give your name to the girl, and ask for me. Thanks a lot," he said. Bernstein suggested that the agent announce loudly that he couldn't talk to any reporters,